told all of us volunteers out the back that the thing that makes LCA so great is that all our speakers are rock stars. So I think this is about as close as you're going to get to seeing you two at a Linux conference. So you all know these guys. Have a good talk.
Hi, I'm Zach from VMware.
I'm Jeremy from Zensos.
I'm Rusty Russell from IBM.
And Chris Wright from Red Hat.
So today we're going to talk to you about virtualization. We're basically going to tell you how to write an x86 hypervisor from scratch. First, we're going to start off with a crash course on virtualization. And then we're going to go into some of the x86 specific details about it and why the twisted and incomprehensible architecture will make you resort to such techniques as pair virtualization. Next, we're going to go over our three different implementations. And then we're going to sum it up with some final points that you can take home to write your own hypervisor. So first, a crash course. Before we actually start talking about virtualization and hypervisors, let's talk for a second about how a traditional kernel supervisor privilege mode works. Typically, there's just two hardware modes. You've got a supervisor mode where the kernel runs, and you've got user code that's unprivileged, which is where the applications run. So the operating system has the ability to issue privilege instructions. For example, disable interrupts when you're taking a spin lock. That's what this CLI instruction up here does. If you try to do that, however, in user mode, what happens is the hardware, when it interprets this instruction, generates a trap. Now that trap goes to the operating system, which will typically kill the offending application for trying to violate the protection. But basically, control over the hardware is what allows the operating system to insulate multiple applications from each other so they can all run simultaneously.
And I did that diagram, which is why it's upside down. So, Southern Hemisphere version.
So what about multiple operating systems? Well, they can't all have control of the hardware at the same time, so how do we solve this? And what if they're running multiple applications?
Yeah, so this is our this is the only thing we're going to say about management of virtualization is this slide.
David Wheeler said, any problem in computer science can be solved with another layer of indirection.
Or two for VMI.
So simply, we make a hypervisor to sit between the hardware and the operating system. Now the hypervisor can interpret and emulate all these privileged instructions when they trap. Going back to this statement, the problem with this is it usually creates another problem.
Okay, so now you're itching to start typing, but first we should, before you implement your x86 hypervisor, we should probably cover a little bit about x86 specifics. The first thing to remember is the x86 doesn't have just those two modes. It has four privilege levels, which they call rings. User space generally gets ring 3, right down the bottom, and the kernel space gets ring 0. So what we can just move the kernel down one to ring 1, as we saw in that diagram, and the hypervisor slides in above at ring 0. And this works well so that you still have protection between user space, the kernel, and the hypervisor. Okay. So what exactly is it that we need to virtualize? Well, we need to virtualize memory. And on x86, that kind of means we need to also deal with these segment tables. We're going to need to deal with interrupts. And we're going to need some way, once we've got that, of doing I/O. And we're going to need to do everything else. So for memory, well, the Linux guest is not allowed to access any memory it wants because, firstly, we're running multiple operating systems. It might not own all the memory. And secondly, the hypervisor has to live somewhere. We can't let it reach the hypervisor. The other thing is, it's the hypervisor which decides which physical pages it's actually going to get. So it may think of it as a linear address space, but in fact, it could be spread all over the place. Now, this is very, very similar to user space virtual memory. So we're going to do a little bit of revision about page tables. When you have a virtual address on x86, you take the top 10 bits and you look it up in this page directory up here on the left. That leads you into another level and use the next 10 bits to find the actual page, the actual address. So that's our normal virtual to physical mapping.
Not to
Okay, so Linux is going to set up these page tables to map virtual to physical. But the hypervisor controls where the actual machine pages are, so we can't just use this because it doesn't know where the machine physical addresses are, only the guest pseudo physical. And also, we need to check anyway that it doesn't try to map things that it's not supposed to. So what we actually do is we have our page table there in the guest, and then we have the real page tables. And when the guest goes to update something, it tells the hypervisor, which does the real update. We call this shadow page tables. The guest maintains its map, as you saw, from virtual to pseudo-physical. The processor needs the virtual to the actual machine physical, so the third side of the triangle is the mapping kept in the hypervisor from what the guest thinks of as physical and the actual physical page. Then the hypervisor checks and mirrors this to the real page table.
So the trouble with shadow page tables is that they suck. The page tables end up using twice as much memory because there's the guest copy of all of those page tables and then there's the actual page tables that the hardware really uses. There's an update overhead on every single page table update. Every time the guest updates the page table, it has to transmit that through to the hypervisor. And when the hypervisor or the hardware modifies the page table bits, they have to be reflected back into the guest's copy. If what you really want is a page table that the hardware can use directly, why not have the guest modify that, generate those page tables itself? So the way it works in Xen is that the guest kernel still thinks it's using physical addresses, but these are really pseudo-physical addresses. And the page table that underlies the guest address space allows the kernel to still use those physical addresses as normal. The only time it really matters that they're not really physical addresses is in page table entries. So when the guest is constructing a page table entry, it goes through the physical to machine mapping array, which maps the pseudo-physical address into a real machine address. So you have a page table. It wants to insert a new entry. It looks up in the physical to machine mapping and inserts the machine address into that page table. Now, obviously, this can cause problems if the guest really is allowed to put anything at once into the page table. You end up with the problems that Rusty referred to earlier. So the page tables are actually mapped read-only into the guest address space. And when the guest tries to write into those page tables, it causes a write fault. The hypervisor sees that, looks to see what's being done to the page table, makes sure it's all okay, and then inserts that entry into the page table. And if it's not a valid page table update, the instruction just faults as if it were a normal write fault. So we see here that it's going through the physical machine mapping and it's about to insert an entry, takes the trap, goes into Xen, and Xen does the update if appropriate. So you'd think that all of these faults could get pretty expensive, but it turns out that the bulk of page table operations happen when you're either setting up a process on fork or exec, or when you're pulling it down on exit. And what happens in Xen is that the page table is initially just a chunk of ordinary read-write pages. It sets up the bulk of the page table at that point. And so all those memory writes are just memory writes. And when the page table gets attached into the real page table or gets used as a real page table, Xen validates it at that point and says yay or nay.
Meanwhile, thanks, Jeremy. Oh, can I have that? Whether you use their crazy scheme or the way God intended you to do virtualization, and by God I mean IBM in the 60s, we're going to look a bit more at these PTE, these page table entries that I had in the little boxes. Because they're referring to whole pages, we actually have spare bits at the bottom. And we've got 12 bits there that you can see. The one I'm going to concentrate on is this U bit in the PTE. There's only one bit that says what privilege level you have to be, what ring you have to be to access this page table. And that's unfortunate. When the bit isn't set, it means that user space can't access that. Ring 3 cannot access page table entries that don't have the user bit set. Well, that's fine for the kernel because it only cares about user space, and we use this to protect the kernel memory from user space programs. But because there's only a single bit, it doesn't help us at all when we're trying to protect the hypervisor in ring 0 from the kernel in ring 1. But fortunately, x86 has these wonderful things called segments. And the way it works is there's this descriptor table somewhere called the global or local descriptor table. And it effectively enforces a limit for virtual addresses. Right? And in this segment table, each ring ends up using its own segments, its own entries in the table. So you can set things up so that you don't let rings 1 to 3 access the top 64 meg of memory, which gives your hypervisor a place to live. Okay, so we've virtualized memory. So far, so good. Interrupts. Well, we've already seen in Zach's example that CLI disables interrupts, and then STI re-enables them. You can't actually let the guest really disable interrupts, because then they could freeze the machine. So when it disables interrupts, the hypervisor just remembers that that guest doesn't want interrupts and simply doesn't send it any. That's pretty easy. I/O. Now you've got memory maps and you've got interrupts happening. You actually want some way for the guest kernel to talk to the outside world, so we need I/O. Well, if you actually allow a guest to talk directly to a device, then it can tell that device to write or read anywhere in memory, which obviously breaks the whole isolation thing that we're trying to achieve. In practice, you have two choices. You either emulate real devices, or you create simplified ones. Okay, so now we solved I/O. We're down to a couple of miscellaneous things. Obviously, something like halt, for example, turns off the processor until interrupt. Well, you can't let that happen. You can't let the guest turn the processor off. CPU ID is kind of interesting. It's the way that you find out from the CPU what capabilities are available, what extensions it has. Now, obviously, the hypervisor might not support some of these, so you actually want to filter that and probably lie to the guest about what capabilities, hide capabilities from the guest.
Now, the problem with CPU ID is that it sucks. CPU ID isn't a privileged instruction, so we can't hide any of these processor capabilities from the guest. This means the kernel, similarly, can't hide capabilities from user space. For example, say a chip had an SSE3 bug. There's no way to mask that to user space. User space can read CPU ID and find out, oh, this feature's supported, I'm free to use these instructions. Say the processor doesn't support sysenter. The kernel doesn't support sysenter, but the user space program detects the presence of the sysenter instruction and tries to use the vsyscall page. This is not something that is appropriate. But how can we actually change this if the instruction won't trap?
QMU?
CPU ID isn't the only instruction like this. There's about 16 other sensitive instructions on the Intel architecture, the worst of which is actually POPF and IRID. So POPF will set the processor flags, which controls whether interrupts are enabled, and it also controls your I/O privilege level. But unfortunately, when run in non-CPL0 mode, it silently ignores updates to these interrupt flag and IOPL fields. And this is bad because now under paravirtualization, we're actually running the kernel in ring 1, so the kernel can't actually run this instruction directly. Pushf is also a problem. It actually reveals the interrupt state. So if the kernel's trying to determine if it's already enabled interrupts from looking at the flags, it sees the flags, and it thinks interrupts are always on because the hypervisor always has to leave interrupts enabled so that it can take interrupts on behalf of the guest.
You end up looping somewhere in do soft IRQ from experience.
But there is a way to solve this, and this brings us to paravirtualization. So with open source operating systems, we actually have the OS source code. This means we don't need to try to work around these problems with some complex solution like a binary translator. This means we actually have to be smarter by replacing the non-trapping instructions.
What kind of idiot would write a binary translator?
What kind of clever person would be able to write a binary translator? So this is what we've done with our paravert code and 2620. We've removed the ring 0 assumption from the kernel. It's now able to run at any of the supervisor privilege levels, 0, 1, or 2. We've added a boot path that allows it to detect the presence of a hypervisor and escape to run the hypervisor code instead. We had to disable some of the early boot stuff. For example, APM and ACPI aren't compatible with certain hypervisors.
You would want to be.
And this, all the sensitive and performance critical privilege operations now go through this pervert obstruct. The pervert obstruct contains just a few function pointers, which for the most part are related to memory management, because overall the MMU is actually the most complicated part of this. By
we like to refer to pervert ops as svelte.
By default, the pervert ops actually point to native versions of all of these. What this means is that you can take a pervert ops compiled kernel and you can boot it on native hardware. It will run perfectly fine. You can also boot the same kernel on a Xen hypervisor. You can boot the same kernel on a VMware hypervisor. And you can boot the same kernel on the most commercially successful hypervisor, Elgast. So basically what the hypervisor does during init is it overwrites the pervert ops table with pointers to its own functions that replace all of these sensitive and MMU-related functions. So I've already talked about the three implementations that we have. Now I'll hand it over to Chris.
All right. Let's take a look at Xen. You've probably heard of Xen. It's this hypervisor. It's GPL that does a bunch of stuff. Actually, we support PAE, SMP, 32-bit, 64-bit, pair virtualization, as well as full virtualization.
And a partridge in a pear tree.
That's right. And more. I just wanted to talk quickly about the Xen boot sequence. As you heard earlier, we have this pervert ops structure that we're trying to fill out. Our first bit here is to give the domain builder for Xen some static information to help identify what type of features we need from the hypervisor, where we want our hypercall page set, and exactly where we want to be called to enter the guest. When we start up, we get stashed away some shared information that we'll need to know about the hypervisor, and then we go ahead and jump to the regular pervert startup sequence.
So why don't you use the built-in pervert probe that
we deemed it wasn't cool.
Why don't you use the built-in pervert probe that I wrote?
We also deemed it wasn't cool.
Why do you use that?
Well, now I'm reconsidering.
The boot sequence is simplified for us. We start up with a lot of things done for us already by the fact that we're running on a hypervisor. We have paging mode enabled already. We're in 32-bit mode. We have page tables set up. We have the GDT set up, PAE if necessary. So let's talk a little bit about getting interrupts going. Clearly, we can't let the guest dictate the hardware IDT, interrupt descriptor table. So rather than writing using the IDT directly, we have hypercalls for setting up the IDT. Through a clever and cunning hack, we are able to use this to get near-native performance for system calls in the guest. And all of our interrupts coming back from the hypervisor are delivered on a single callback. This is effectively the Xen event channel mechanism. The event channel mechanism allows us to dynamically map Xen event channels to IRQs, and we have the ability to mask on and off events necessary for normal IRQ processing, and of course we can globally enable and disable interrupts.
So why don't you call them virtual IRQs like everyone else?
That wouldn't be cool either.
We're special.
You are special.
And I'd like to turn this over to my friend.
I cry foul. This is corporate espionage if I've ever seen it. This isn't our logo. So I'm going to talk to you about VMI, which is our virtual machine interface. VMI is a layer between the kernel and the hypervisor, a cute, cuddly layer. Basically, VMI is about the idea of having a layer here and what that actually gives you. It's not about any particular binary API between the kernel and the hypervisor. It's a method to actually translate the two APIs between each other. The idea is you can have one kernel that will run anywhere on any hardware, on any hypervisor. So you can have multiple VMI layers created for any sufficient kernel API for many different operating systems and for many different hypervisors. Kernel APIs actually changed. The Pervert Ops API has changed a lot since it began.
Perfect.
It will continue to change as it adapts for KVM. And we need a way to interface this to future versions of hypervisors. The idea of future compatibility is really key to making virtualization successful as a platform. If a customer actually installs a virtual machine today, they still want it to run 5, 7, 10 years from now, when it's now running on different hardware, possibly in a different hypervisor. We have to build this capability into the platform now, because 10 years from now, it's too late. If 10 years from now, an application is trying to make hyper calls to an obsolete hypervisor, that's not going to work. Then we're going to have to build in all this legacy support that virtualization was actually trying to get rid of in the first place. Okay. There was a slide here that actually went missing, but I'll continue on without it. So where does this VMI code live, and what is it? Okay. I'm gonna go with this. So where is this VMI code, and where does it live? Well, it's actually not part of the operating system, because we're trying to build in future compatibility. We can't actually put the code in the operating system. That would presume the operating system is actually smart enough to know how to run 5 years from now when hardware looks completely different. And we aren't smart enough to figure that out now. So instead, we build in a mechanism for elaborating on that and allowing it to actually continue into the future. So this code is actually published by the hypervisor. It's published by the hypervisor because hypervisor implementations change, new hypervisors emerge, and hardware changes. So the hypervisor APIs will actually change through time. So how does it work? So it's really similar to vSyscall or the Xen hypercall page. First, there's a call into this layer, which calls into the hypervisor. It merely translates the two APIs between each other. So now there's some license issues implied by this, because we're actually talking about taking a piece of code which doesn't live in the kernel, calling into it, and having it call into some external agent. So there's a hypervisor implementation here that is now being almost linked to by the kernel. It's not linked into the kernel, but it is actually called out to by the kernel. So we found a way to circumvent this. The easy solution to this problem is to GPL it. So you can actually download the GPL'd VMI ROM. It's on SourceForge. The project is VMI-Linux. And you can download and build the ROM, which will work on our upcoming Workstation 6. So hopefully, the goal of this is that maybe every OS can just work under every hypervisor. And that's really what we'd like to see. Think of the children. There's many different operating systems out there. They can all benefit from virtualization, and we'd like to see them all thrive, even ones that use segmentation.
So Lguest is a tiny little hypervisor that I wrote that implements the minimum Paravert ops that you just need to demonstrate a Linux guest on an identical Linux host. And it's simple. We, on almost every interrupt trap, we basically jump to this stub sitting at the top of memory, which just saves out all the guest state, restores the host state, and jumps back into the main kernel. And it has a simplified, efficient I/O model. We do not support SMP, PAE.
CPUs.
64-bit. We have a very clear policy of avoiding features in favor of puppies. Puppies. Oh, yeah. So before we finish, there are a couple of final things that we didn't get time to cover that you'll need to know when you go out and build your x86 hypervisor. I want to mention VertBench, There are some other technologies out there. There's a little bit of history behind this stuff that you should go out and look up. And there are a few other minor issues that you should also consider. Questions? Can you nest hypervisors was the question.
No.
Sometimes. If they nest using different mechanisms, in some cases it's possible. Your performance is going to be awful, though.
Hardly ever.
That sounds like a feature to me. Puppies.
So you have these Paravid ops, you probably call them... You call them all the
Somebody
time.
Somebody hacked the slides, thank you.
And especially in performance critical bits of code. Do you actually call through indirect function protocol all over the place, or do you dynamic patch your binary, putting the right jumps in the right place?
Well, thank you, Ben, I'm glad you asked. So, the question was, aren't all these indirect calls through Paravert Ops slow? It's amazing how this works. With config paravert on, a CLI instruction, which is our old friend which disables interrupts, becomes this 12-byte instruction sequence. Plus, of course, it actually calls out to the CLI and RET instructions. So you end up with an indirect branch and running... Thank you, Andrew. Okay, so... It turns out that some paravert ops are more popular than others. So we actually just do what every cool system will do, which is binary patch it during boot. So you write a trivial little bit of code, and then you iterate through them during boot like this, and you just get to replace them, depending on your whatever backend you've got. So you know, VMI might implement patching, does implement patching, Xen.
Real soon now.
Real soon now. Lguest sounds like a feature. Puppies. So the backend can actually decide how and whether to patch all these instructions. And the result on native, for example, looks like this. You get CLI, it becomes this, but then when you do your binary patching, it returns to CLI and a couple of no-ops. So we claw most of the performance, almost all of the performance back by doing binary patching on the popular ones, and the others don't really matter.
Yeah, given that Intel 386 now has VT, all that other stuff, do you think there's room for having a less brain-damaged hardware walk page table on x86?
Jeremy?
The current hardware support doesn't support nested page tables, which is the sort of hardware feature you need to essentially do shadow page tables and hardware. AMD will soon, I guess, and yep. Intel will at some point in the future. Later. And even if they do have it in hardware, there's no guarantee that it's actually going to be very fast. The history of VT so far has shown that their initial implementations are horrifically slow, and I'm pretty much expecting the first cut of any of these bits of hardware, these hardware features, will be slow. And aside from that, I don't quite understand why they're putting all this stuff in hardware, because having a software TLB mishandler would actually solve all of this much more efficiently.
Actually, also, we've designed the pervert ops that aren't necessary to be phased out. So while some of these may be appropriate for current generation hardware and the current generation of the kernel, over time, as I said, the kernel API will actually change to match the hardware.
And as you see already with KVM, which is using directly VT support and AMDV support, once you start leveraging paravert ops, you can find the best blend for performance.
Yeah.
And we expect to see some of these things actually migrate to hardware as we see performance.
So we lied. We said there are three projects using paravert ops. There's 3.5. I mean, KVM, Ingo's already put paravert hooks in, because if you want the performance back, you've basically got to paravirtualize. And he's using paravert ops as well, but it's not in mainline. Another Ben question?
Yeah. I've seen that your page tables are mapped in read-only, which means that your guest operating system can see the physical, the real physical addresses. Isn't that causing a problem to some security maniacs?
No. I mean, it can only see its own page table, so I mean, it can see the real page numbers, but that's not terribly interesting information in itself. There is a table that will map physical, like machine addresses, back into physical. I don't think that tells you anything very interesting either. So.
No, not, I haven't found a way to exploit it, but I had people screaming about it in another hypervisor context in the past, so that's what I was asking.
It is actually a huge covert channel designed into the system.
So we had it for different reasons. I had it because it's a feature. So. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It's not a covert channel, it's open source.
Yeah. They don't understand that.
So with this and other similar VMware QEMU, I'm hiding in the middle of all of you. Yeah. There's a lot of need for virtual hardware, and at the moment we virtual devices to pass through. So at the moment QEMU and these sorts of things emulate the simple hardware, NE2000s, some sort of easy video card. Is there going to be a standard virtual video card and a standard virtual network card that you can then map through fairly easily to real hardware underneath?
That's a really good question. And certainly... Okay, so the... Sorry?
There probably will be 17 of them.
Yeah, we will have a number of standards from which to choose. Yeah, it's actually one of the hot areas at the moment is now how do we do, you know, paravirtualized I.O. and these simple drivers in a way that doesn't suck. I have my implementation. There are other implementations out there. We will hopefully end up with some commonality between the I.O. subsystem.
The fortunate thing about the actual device drivers is device drivers are by default vendor code and they're vendor specific code, so they're already well modularized and separated, and the kernel knows how to deal with multiple different types of these things, and it, as long as they're compiled as modules, it shouldn't add overhead to the platform.
More questions? No? To repeat the question, he said, I think Rusty Visor is a horrible name. Why do people keep saying the Rusty Visor when they mean Elgast? And I think there are several reasons. But I don't know what they are. Have a vote. Okay, let's do that. Who thinks it should be called the Rusty Visor? And who thinks it should be called Elgast? Oh, look, I win. We can do it again if you want. So, it was originally called L-Hype, and the reason it changed is because I got this passionate email from Ingo Molnar saying, I hate the name so much, I could never hack on your code if it's called L-Hype.
Wouldn't that save it?
Yeah, no. And I like riding on Ingo's coattails, so I changed the guest. Sorry. A real-time L-Hype, it's exactly what we want, yeah. Oh wait, puppies, sorry.
So all this work on hypervisors and virtualizations, isn't this just a whole lot of energy being put into the wrong problem? And, you know, we're doing all this virtualization hypervisor stuff to solve the failings of operating systems that you can't isolate processes properly from each other in the current OSs. Shouldn't we just solve that problem and fix the operating system rather than adding yet another layer of interaction?
There are two points here. One is, we should just fix the operating system. Yes, but which bit of this is fun did you not get from the talk?
There is also the fact that having an external agent can provide a lot of additional security benefits and a lot of migration capabilities that are very difficult to build into an operating system. It's hard for a system to actually move itself to another platform when it's actually running on a platform with page tables and all of these things. It's very hard to connect to an external agent unless you have a management component that can actually do that for you.
Yeah, Zach, he said you had an ugly baby. You attack.
And it's curious as it may sound, people actually do run other operating systems and do occasionally want to do it at the same time.
Not on Elgest.
Any more?
Should Linux become a hypervisor?
It is. We're stuck with that.
I think there's pretty much unanimous agreement that KVM is a good thing for Linux, for all hypervisors, because it's actually going to provide a stable in kernel API that we can work with so that we can come up with a solution that works for all vendors. So.
Yeah, LHype uses the same model, where basically the hypervisor is, other than the tiny little stub, it's a Linux module. You modprobe LHype and you go LGuest, and you go. So, yeah, I think you can leverage all those scheduler and stuff, all that scalability work we've done, and you get that for free. So, yeah, I would say yes.
So long as you own open CPU.
You know, features, puppies.
Our question back to the previous question is, next. If you're asking Linux, what's your difference in the definition between a hypervisor and an operating system? They're pretty much the same, in fact, except exporting another user API.
Where did he go?
Yeah, I don't know that we want to get into debates about what is the difference between a hypervisor and an operating system. If your operating system's like your... Yeah. Fun. Writing your own hypervisor is fun. It took me, from knowing nothing about x86 to writing a hypervisor, took me a week. Getting it to work took only three more. So I would encourage you to go out and, you know, procreate hypervisors.
why did they build the x86 so broken? Why did they? I'm down here. Sorry.
I don't think they intended it that way. It just sort of started growing over time, and there's. The idea of legacy support was very important and still continues to be, so now you've got a lot of interesting quirks in the architecture.
Yeah, the 16-bit chip that became a 32-bit chip, that became a 64-bit chip, is going to be as ugly as it sounds, I think.
And then why did they build the four rings in, if they were only ever going to use two of them, and then there were just two spare rings?
Well, there used to just be zero.
Yeah, so four is better than two. That's why there are four. Except,
puppies.
Yeah.
The real answer is that at the time they did that, four rings was cool.
Yeah.
I thought it was five golden rings.
No, you're thinking nine.
What are the issues involved in binary patching that makes it prohibitive for you?
Binary patching that makes it prohibitive?
For full virtualization. For, you know, when you want to replace a single instruction with many instructions.
Well, you can't replace a single instruction because that becomes visible to the guest code. If you actually change the guest instruction stream, it can go read its own instruction stream. Many applications actually do this. There's copy protection schemes that are built in that will actually go recorrect the code for you. And you can't be guaranteed the guest is never going to do that. So in order to keep it from viewing its own instruction stream, you actually need to run a separate instruction stream from that.
You get very close to QEMU at that point, and we have QEMU. Yeah. So.
All right. Maybe this will be the last question.
Last question. And then we'll do...
If x86 is so broken, what platforms lead themselves to virtualization better?
That answer is actually really easy. Power was designed for virtualization. It's used, you know, it's built into the chips. The S390, look at that. That's classic. But Of course, Intel is actually, and AMD are putting features in to catch up. So it may be completely broken, but it may get less broken over time.
I wouldn't say it's completely broken. I mean, we managed to use the segmentation feature to create pair virtualization for 32-bit.
Yeah. So, okay, so just we'll get one last statement. We'll go backwards from Chris.
What's the statement?
Thank you. Just some final summary of everything you want
to... Oh, well, first of all, thanks for coming to the talk. And second of all, please come work on Paravert Ops because it's really fun. Okay.
Yeah. Features kill pup.
Zenas. Don't hate me.
He said Zen is not that bad.
VMI is cute and cuddly.
And it's a thin layer.
Very thin.
Okay. Thank you very much.